The Maya Calendar Wheels. The Mayan calendar, now decipherable thanks to Diego de Landa's basic research, now brings us to the next piece of craziness from this jungle people. Its smallest unit was a week, with 13 days. Just imagine a small cogwheel with 13 teeth engraved with the Maya numbers from 1 to 13. Next comes a month of 20 days, in our mind's eye, a cogwheel with 20 teeth. Now bring the small cog and the larger cog together and mark the zero position. On the small cog, the point for 1. On the larger one, the Maya word for imish. After 13 turns, the two wheels return to this start position. In total, 260 teeth have run through this cycle, equivalent to a Maya year with 260 days. But, everybody knows this, a year doesn't have 260 days. It has 365 days. A 260-day calendar would be no use to man nor beast on our Earth. You couldn't mark off spring or fall. There'd be no fixed date for sowing or harvesting. To this day, no one knows why the Maya used a 260-day year. Therefore, it is known as the God Year, or Holy Year. Among the Maya, it was known as Solkin. All of the Mayans' religious rituals took place according to the rhythm of the Solkin. All of their holy dates can be read from the Solkin. For everyday use or agricultural purposes, though, the Solkin calendar was useless. The Maya astronomers knew this. After all, they knew the exact orbital data of the Earth with inexplicable precision. They had measured the exact length of our year to exactly 365.242129 days. That number is more precise than our own calendar. Just for comparison, the Julian calendar equals 365.250000 days. The Gregorian calendar equals 365.242500 days. The Mayan calendar equals 365.242129 days. Absolute astronomical calculation equals 365.242189 days. There are always decimal places behind the point. We compensate for the inaccuracy in our calendar by adding an extra day every 4 years, what we call leap years. That's when those poor souls who are born on February 29th can finally celebrate their birthday again. The Maya did it differently. They added an extra 13 days every 52 years and, with a number of other diverse tricks, managed to create the most precise calendar in the ancient world. To the two cogwheels that represent the Solkin year of 260 days, we must now add a third, larger cogwheel with 365 teeth. The Maya called their 365-day calendar Hab. Now we do the same thing as before, this time with three cogwheels. This time we draw a red mark on all three wheels at the zero position. How long will it take until all three cogwheels get back to their starting positions? There are 18,980 teeth, or days. Put another way, the 365-toothed wheel has turned 52 times. The 260-day wheel has turned 73 times. For the Maya, this meant 52 earthly years were equivalent to 73 God years. The Maya researchers even had a term for this period, a calendar round. The Maya calculated with much greater calendar numbers than the 18,980 days of the calendar round. There are calendar calculations of 23,040,000,000 days, or 64,109,589 years. Some inscriptions even extend 400 million years into the past. How is this possible with a calendar round of only 18,980 days? The solution is a fourth, even bigger cogwheel, which Maya researchers call the long count. These four cogwheels begin in a start phase marked with the ominous glyphs 4 Ahau, 8 Kumhwa, the beginning of the Mayan calendar. But when in the dark mists of time did 4 Ahau, 8 Kumhwa take place? When did the Maya calendar start, in terms of our calendar, that is? This is a question that has caused generations of historians many a sleepless night. On the basis of the religious festivals celebrated after the Spanish conquest, it was possible to count back. In the end, the experts agreed on a date, August 13, 3114 BC. This date was the definitive beginning of the Mayan calendar. So far, so good. But why had the Mayans started their calendar on August 13, 3114 BC? Strictly speaking, according to accepted thinking, the Maya didn't even exist back then. In other words, the start date is older than the people themselves. Every culture has or had its own calendar, and the date on which it begins always marks some incredibly important event. For Christians, it is the birth of Christ. That's where the counting starts. For the Muslims, it is the day on which Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina, 622 AD. The Jewish calendar begins with the creation of the world 5,770 years ago, 3761 BC. So what happened to the forefathers of the Maya that was so unspeakably important that it caused them to start their calendar on August 13, 3114 BC? The Maya have handed down the story in their legends, recorded for posterity in the Book of the Jaguar Priests. It is one of the so-called Chilambalam books that were first written after the Spanish conquest. Luckily, the Spaniards didn't quite manage to wipe out every single one of the priests. A few managed to flee. Holed up in remote hiding places, they wrote down their ancient knowledge on the new paper. This was how the Chilambalam books came about. You can read for yourself. They descended from the street of the stars. They spoke the magic tongue of the stars of heaven. Yea, their sign is our certainty that they came from heaven, and when they return, the 13 gods and the 9 gods, they will reorder what they once created. In Chapter 3, I talked about language, its meaning, and how it has developed and changed. In this quote from the Book of the Jaguar Priests, it must be obvious to even the most ignorant layman that the word heaven used here is a synonym for the term space. From an earthly point of view, in other words, in terms of sowing and harvesting, the monumental Maya cycles made no sense at all. They did in the minds of the Maya. After 37,960 days, for example, the gods started their journey to their great resting place. Applying statements such as these to the Quetzal serpent, that is, spacecraft, may well make sense, but it makes no sense at all if the Quetzal serpent is merely a reference to the Quetzal bird. The Return of Bolon Yokte. Having fixed that start date of the Maya calendar at August 13, 3114 BC, we can now start playing with our cogwheels again. How long will it take until all of the cogwheels of the long count get back to their starting positions? Working that out in today's computer age is a mere trifle. We know the start date, and we know how many teeth are on the cogs. If we transfer the result to our calendar, we see that the Maya calendar comes to an end on Sunday, December 23rd, 2012. That is when the gods are expected to return from their long journey. This is what the inscription on Monument Number 6 in Tortuguero tells us. See the start of this chapter for more. It seems that Bolon Yokte is coming back. One of the Maya people's main gods is known by the experts as Lady Beastie. Her birth date is given as December 7, 3121 BC. In other words, 6 years before the start of the Maya calendar. Lady Beastie is not the only one of the Mayan gods to have come to Earth before the start of the Mayan calendar. There are a number of others, too. In Temple No. 14 in Palenque, Bolon Yokte appears with a deed that took place on the unimaginable date of July 29th, 931,449 BC. How did this date come about if the Maya didn't start counting until August 13th, 3114 BC? Well, it's like this. The calendar may start on August 13th, 3114 BC, but Maya used a special glyph to show what happened before or after the start of their calendar, just as we use the abbreviation BC to describe events that took place before the start of the Christian calendar. But the $64,000 question is this: what's going to happen on Sunday, December 23rd, 2012? Will Bolon Yokte and his cohort of Mayan gods really come back down to Earth? Will we experience a god shock in a couple of years? How can we prepare for this? Prepare? I recommend this book. What else? And what about December 23rd, 2012? Will this day be a catastrophe for mankind? Well, before we can claim anything like that, we'd need to be sure as hell that it's the right date, and, despite the Mayan cogwheels, we're certainly not. Maya specialists spent years arguing when the Mayan calendar began. The theories covered everything from 8498 BC to 3114 BC. The only thing the experts could really agree on was that whichever starting point they took, it would be before the Mayans even existed. They finally settled for August 13th, 3114 BC, because they were able to recalculate religious Maya dates noted during the age of the Spanish conquistadores. So is this date really final and definite? Well, I wouldn't swear to it. Miscalculation? How does this relate, then, to our calendar? Put it this way. I'm sitting here in the year 2009, typing this book into my computer. 2009. That's the number of years that are supposed to have passed since Jesus was born in a lowly cattle shed in Bethlehem. Assuming that the early Christians didn't start counting until 20 years after Jesus' birth, our calendar would be 20 years short. 20 years that exist nowhere. The number 2009 would be wrong. The conversion of the Maya calendar to the Christian calendar is not based on the effective time that has passed, but on the actual dates we use. 2009 is just a number that does not necessarily actually represent the number of years that have really passed. And if the number 2009 isn't right, because a number of years were not even counted, then the number 2012 can't be right either. On top of that, we're not even totally sure which calendar corrections were carried out in the early Middle Ages. If we accept that the early Christians left out 20 years, then the correct date today, in terms of actual elapsed time and not simply the year date, would be 2029, not 2009. In that case, the start date of 3114 BC, calculated for the Maya calendar, would be wrong. Why? Because all the calculations are based on the year dates and not the effectively elapsed time. The calculations run either from before Christ's birth or after it. Regardless of which direction you go, you're still missing 20 years in your calculation. If 20 years after Christ were missing, and in truth, 2029 years had actually passed, then the ominous year 2012, the year in which the gods are set to return, would already be in the past. As we know, nothing happened, leaving aside a number of scientifically well-documented UFO sightings. So, is it all humbug? No. The so-called gods of antiquity, those teachers who instructed our Stone Age forefathers in arts such as astronomy, will return. I know that only too well. There is too much proof available to leave me in any doubt. We cannot fixate on Sunday, December 23rd, 2012, though. It's not just the cultures and religions that I've mentioned already that have this belief in the Second Coming. It pretty much applies to the entire ancient world, from thousands of years ago to the present day. The Christians are waiting for Jesus to return. You can read about it in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 13, verse 26, "And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory." The Mahdi of the Muslims. It's no different in the Islamic world. The Muslims await the coming of the Mahdi. The Imams, the teachers of Islam, continually reiterate that it is wrong to speculate upon the date of the Mahdi, as that is a secret that only Allah may know. Once a stranger asked the fifth Imam, Al-Bakir, what signs would precede the return of the Mahdi. The Imam answered, "It will be when the women act like men, and the men act like women, and when the women sit with spread legs upon saddled horses. It will be when false witnesses are believed, and when truth is rejected. Then when men spill the blood of other men for no good reason, when they fornicate and squander the money of the poor." According to these criteria, the Mahdi should have been here long ago. But, the Islamic scholars tell us, before it can happen, 60 false prophets must come. I have no idea how many false prophets there have been, but the number must have exceeded 60 a long time ago. Islamic literature is totally unclear on when and where this coming will take place. The Mahdi is the Redeemer of the final days. He will come on the 23rd night of the month of Ramadan. This night is the night of power, Laylat al-Qadr, in which the Quran was revealed, the night in which the angels descend. Judaism is no stranger to this idea either. Faithful Jews have been waiting for the second coming of their Messiah for more than 5,000 years. The Jews, of course, never accepted Jesus as the Messiah. The basic concept also crops up in the ancient Iranian Parsi religion. The Avesta, it means basic text or teaching, contains the religious texts of the Parsis, the followers of Zarathustra. Zarathustra himself is said to have been born as a result of an immaculate conception. According to Zoroastrian tradition, a mountain swathed in pure light descended from heaven. A youth emerged from this mountain bearing the embryo of Zarathustra, which he then implanted in his mother's womb. Fragments of this ancient religion are preserved in cuneiform texts that were made at the order of King Darius the Great, circa 549 to 486 BC, his son Xerxes, 485 to 465 BC, and his grandson Artaxerxes, 464 to 424 BC. The highest object of worship is the divinity Ahura Mazda. He is depicted as a ring with wings who reigns over the world. The similarity to the winged sun disks in Egypt can hardly be missed. All the gods are coming back. According to the text of the Parsis, the constellations are subdivided into star clusters that are ruled by various commanders. Then it gets quite military-sounding as they talk about the soldiers of the star systems who fight their battles throughout the universe. The Quadriga Solis, the four-wheeled chariot pulled by winged horses, has its roots in Iranian culture. Here, the gods of the various planets are said to steer the chariot of the sun. In the Yashts, a kind of subdivision of the Avesta, you can read in chapter 10, verses 67 and 68, "Who drives along on his high-wheeled chariot made of a heavenly substance from the Karshvare of Arezahai to the Karshvare of Zwanirafa, white, shining, seen afar, beneficent, endowed with knowledge, swiftly carry along the heavenly space." Chapter 10, verse 125. "Four stallions draw that chariot, all of the same white color, living on heavenly food and undying." Space seems to be full of such flying machines, and the differences between terms like arrow, bird, heavenly food, and made of a heavenly substance show that the Parsis knew what they were talking about. Of course, the Parsis too expected their gods to return. light beings would descend from heaven, they believed. Zarathustra himself asked his god Ahura Mazda about the end of time and was told that all conquering ones would come down from the skies. They are immortal, their intellects perfect. Before these divinities appear in the firmament, the sun will go dark, the world will be battered by a mighty storm wind, and a star will fall from heaven. Following a terrible battle, a new dawn will break for humanity. Then mankind will be so well versed in healing that even those who are close to death will not die. The difference here to the redeemers of other religions is not so dramatic at a glance, except for the fact that this time it is the all-conquerors who are coming to save the world. These are the ones that the Parsis were waiting for, the gods from the canopy of the stars. In Hinduism, it gets even more complex because of the panoply of gods. Originally, so they believe, the world was free of greed or desires, a place of such happiness that we could scarce imagine it. This enviable paradise survived until negative spirits, but also gods, confused the minds of men. The gods were, admittedly, omnipotent and immortal beings with great power. However, they also displayed a distinctly human nature and had a penchant for taking on human form. The greatest of them all was the ruler of the heavens, Indra, who was lord over all. In Vanaparvan, part of the ancient Indian epic Mahabharata, chapters 168 to 173, the gods are said to have lived in veritable space cities that orbited high above the earth. Here we can say with some certainty that any religious psychological interpretation is barking up the wrong tree. The following quotes prove it. In the volume Dronaparva, also a part of the Mahabharata, you can read on page 690, verse 62, how three exquisitely built space cities circle the earth. What followed was a veritable space battle. Siva, riding on that excellent car which was composed of all the celestial forces, proceeded for the destruction of the triple city. When, however, the three cities came together in the firmament, the Lord Mahadeva pierced them with that terrible shaft of his, consisting of three knots. The text was translated from the Sanskrit into English in 1888. Nobody back then could have had a clue about intergalactic motherships, that is, cities in the firmament. And anyone who comes up with the objection that heavenly cities could simply have been just holy places on earth will be forced to capitulate in the face of the concrete statement about three cities in the firmament. What's more, the destruction of cities in the firmament clearly rules out any holy place on earth. The core of this tale, battles in heaven, wars between the gods, is the decisive factor that leaves the psychologically motivated idea of heaven as represented by the researchers of the old school looking somewhat farcical. Also, the often repeated objection that mankind has simply always had the need for a savior or some other similar heavenly figure just doesn't wash in the face of the sheer quantity of documented cases. The messages speak for themselves. Of course, the Hindus also have their own belief in a second coming. They believe that Vishnu will be born again as Krishna to save the world. Older than Buddha. The precursor of Buddhism is the religion of the Jaina, known as Jainism. According to their teachings, the current age is simply one of many, like the Maya and others. Once, they say, so-called Tirthankaras descended from heaven. The first of these was Rishabha, and he visited our planet an incredible 8,400,000 years ago. You would expect teachers such as this, arriving from outer space, to have certain astronomical and astrophysical knowledge. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the Jaina know astronomical data that we do not understand. Their teachings say that dimensions of the universe can be measured. The unit of measurement for this is the Raju, that is, the distance that the gods cover in 6 months when they travel at a speed of 2,057,152 yojanas every same, blink of an eye. We have a similar unit of measurement. What, after all, is a light year? It is roughly 6 trillion miles. According to the Jaina, the entire universe is filled with life that is distributed unevenly around the cosmos. In Jaina thinking, primitive life and plants can be found on all planets that are not too hot or not too cold, but only certain planets can sustain beings with voluntary movements. And what about second comings? This is where it really gets good. In a divine realm known as Kalpas, there are said to be magnificent flying palaces the size of whole cities. These heavenly residences were built like apartment blocks, one floor over the next, so that the Vimanas, the heavenly flying machines, would be able to fly out in any direction. Every time a new age begins and a new Tirthankaras is born, a bell rings out in the main palace of the heavenly realm. It is so arranged that this bell triggers bells in all the other 3,199,999 heavenly palaces. Then the gods gather, partially from the love of the Tirthankaras and partially out of curiosity. Those who so desire visit our solar system in a mighty flying palace, and a new age dawns on Earth. The same numbers, but where did they come from? The Buddhists believe that sometime in the future, the exalted Maitreya, also called Maitreya, will appear on Earth, the perfect Buddha. The Buddhists think in terms of absolutely unbelievable numbers, their so-called yugas. What is most amazing with these is their consistency with completely separate sources. The number 4,320,000 of the Mahayuga, the Great Age, is identical with the third antediluvian king, Enmen Luana. He ruled for 12 sars. A sar is a period of 3,600 years, and 12 times 3,600 equals 43,200. You can read this on the Sumerian King List, WB444, which is kept today in the British Museum in London. So how does this fit together? Or let's take the number 288,000 of the Deva Yugas. This corresponds to the number of the sixth ancient king, known as En-Sipa-Zid-Ana. He managed to rule for 8 sars. That adds up to 28,800 years. The numbers are the same, give or take the odd zero. In Greece, you can find allusions to a so-called world age in the works of the poet Heraclitus. He set this number at 10,800,000 years. The same number corresponds to the second period of the Sumerian kings, namely 30 sars, or 108,000 years. This playing around with numbers just goes to show that there is some kind of common denominator running through everything. At some time, back in the mists of time, there must have been something like a standardized source. Otherwise, all these relationships don't make sense. This common origin must lie way, way back in the dim and distant past. If it were otherwise, the history books would have some mention of it. In all my contemplations of second comings, the science of psychology doesn't provide me with any clues. There is no basic pattern from out of the psychological pigeonhole that explains these identical numbers or identical attributes. Smoke, fire, quaking, noise, described during the descent of the gods, or the artificial inseminations described in the ancient texts. Just for comparison, Catholic Christians believe that Jesus was the result of an immaculate conception. However, the idea of immaculate conceptions is millennia older. Countless major gods and god kings from ancient times are said to have been conceived immaculately. A lot of this may have been simply self-aggrandizement or narcissism on the part of the royal dynasties. After all, no leader wanted to be seen as anything less than any of his predecessors. The origin of this belief, though, is based on actual events. The gods, equal ETs, did carry out artificial inseminations. even the origin of the Egyptian royal dynasty can be traced back to the gods. The ancient historians, those who actually worked thousands of years ago, wrote, without exception, of a race of gods that provided the seed of the first kings. Mankind did not know much about astronomy until they learned it from the gods, as was also the case with the arts of tool-making and working the soil. Even language and writing systems came courtesy of these helpful heavenly beings. They were namely the ones who first structured comprehensible language and gave many things names that previously had had none. Today's science ignores these reports. They are not seen as helpful. There are too many of them. In the Apocrypha, too, there is talk of heavenly teachers, although here they are referred to as fallen angels. In the Jewish traditions, there are no end of chosen ones whose seed was not of earthly origin. It's something that most people would rather sweep under the carpet. They prefer not to dirty their fingers with such concepts. And suddenly, Erich von Däniken is associated with idiotic racists, as if the heavenly seed were my idea and I had made up the chosen ones myself. To make it clear for those who still haven't understood, this entire way of thinking is not the product of my imagination. It comes straight out of those very books that for many people are the holiest of all writings. Noah, a child of the ETs. Consequently, Noah, the survivor of the flood, was not just anybody. Admittedly, his earthly father is given as Lamech, but Lamech never fathered his son. You can read about this in the Lamech Scroll, one of the famous Dead Sea Scrolls. It tells how Lamech returned home one day from a long journey of several months. Upon entering his tent, he found a young boy who did not seem to be of his family. He had different eyes, a different hair color, and even a different skin color. Furious, Lamech confronted his wife, but she swore by all that is holy to her that she had not been unfaithful, neither with a soldier nor with one of the sons of God. Worried, Lamech set off to ask his father for advice. This worthy one was none other than Methuselah himself. He, too, was unable to help, and turned to his own father for help, namely Lamech's grandfather. This was Enoch, the seventh antediluvian prophet. Enoch said to his son Methuselah that he should tell Lamech to accept this strange child as if it were his own. The heavenly beings had laid their seed in the lap of his wife without sexually abusing her. This young cuckoo was destined to become the progenitor of a new race after the flood. Lamech was to call the lad Noah, and he did. What does this delightful story have to do with the return of the gods? This episode shows that Enoch, Lamech's grandfather, already knew about the coming flood catastrophe. In other words, the flood was no natural catastrophe, it was planned. And the Most High, the starship captain, who had had Enoch kidnapped, told him this personally. Who arranged the artificial insemination of Lamech's wife? The same space travelers who also instructed Enoch in several branches of science and carried him away from the earth in a fiery chariot. Enoch is another one who, after a long absence, is expected to return to the earth. Gazar came from the heavens too. In his flawlessly documented book on ancient Tibet, Willy Gromlin proves that the original Tibetan kings were extraterrestrial in origin. Gasar was one such. He possessed a flying machine that mightily impressed his people and even brought an alien object with him down to Earth, the Dorji. It was a kind of multi-purpose weapon. Models of it can be seen in Tibetan temples. These aliens also brought indecipherable writings with them from the skies. Some of these remain hidden in a cave for the future generations who are capable of understanding them. The original kings of Tibet came from outer space. Some of them returned there later with the promise that they would return sometime in the distant future. What else? We've strayed from the point somewhat. We were actually talking about the return of the gods of the Mayan world. But the Maya weren't alone in their beliefs, whether they knew it or not. The expectation that the gods will return remains an irrevocable fact. Worldwide, Christians and Jews await their Messiah, and Muslims the Mahdi, merely another word for a messianic figure. A normal person who later becomes a king cannot be a Messiah, for the simple reason that the word man, or human, or person, is totally inappropriate for explaining the Messiah. Professor Hugo Gressman, a recognized exegete for the Old Testament, analyzes it thus. For both to be the same thing seems to be more than unlikely, for the Messiah appears to be a heavenly being. What is more, he is also considered to be pre-existent. He existed before humans were even around. Clearly, not all religions can be right. Some of them must be barking up the wrong tree, mustn't they? But what if all of them are wrong? The motif of returning gods belongs no more to the Maya than it does to the Inca people, the Egyptians, the Buddhists, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, or anyone else on this earth. This expectation of some kind of return is global and harks back to a promise given by the extraterrestrials to our forefathers thousands of years ago. "We'll be back," they said to some of their students. The Maya have preserved this promise literally and even give a date for it, December 23rd, 2012. If our calendar is right, then this is a date that we could pretty much rely on. They're coming back! You can be absolutely certain that those ETs, or their descendants, will be making another visit to our planet. It can be proved. So it's all the more inexplicable to me why this simple truth triggers such a clamorous reaction in our society, why ethnologists reject it so indignantly. The denial practiced by organized religions is no great surprise. The exegetic interpretations so far have just produced greater confusion. They have, and this in no way diminishes my great respect for the industrious work by the translators of the ancient texts, simply led to nothing. What's more, the plethora of contradictions will continue to exist because the starting premises are false. Quetzal serpent is just one term in a litany of thousands that are and will remain meaningless as long as the science of psychology insists on talking even the banalest things to pieces. In my book, Der Gotteschock, The God Shock, I believe I have painted a pretty clear and, most importantly, well-founded picture of how our forefathers came to see the divine in technical devices. The feedback I've received from my worldwide readership shows that they have certainly understood. The only problem is that the scientists in charge insist on understanding nothing. Their prejudices and preconceptions cloud their judgment so much that none of them would ever dare to support my theories in public. It's not only the so-called gods who will be returning, though. To support themselves, those beings from outer space will also reactivate the many objects and texts that have been deposited on the Earth, deposited millennia ago for just this purpose. Those legendary teachers did not just pack up all their belongings when they rocketed off into the beyond. Looking ahead to the distant future, they left behind many things in indestructible storage depots. But why should they do something so seemingly banal, something so human? So they would have proof in the future that they, or their forefathers, had been here before many thousands of years ago, and that they had left such objects behind. Where? In a cave in Tibet, those very gods deposited texts and objects for use in the future. These are described by Willy Gromling from page 263 onward in his book. In Egypt, in the hidden rooms under the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx, as well as under the Osirion and Abydos. And finally, in Ecuador in South America, at the coordinates 77 degrees, 47 minutes, 34 seconds west, and 1 degree, 56 minutes, 0 seconds south. This is the location of a library of metal panels stored deliberately for the future, By whom? By those very aliens who made it into the Book of Mormon. Admittedly, this is a religious work just like the Bible, but the Book of Mormon starts by describing events in ancient times, just like in the Bible. Here are a couple of passages from chapter 8, verse 16 and following. And blessed be he that shall bring this thing to light, for it shall be brought out of darkness unto light, according to the word of God. Yea, it shall be brought out of the earth, and it shall shine forth out of darkness, and come unto the knowledge of the people. 26. And none can stay it, and it, the texts, shall come in a day when it shall be said that miracles are done away, and it shall come even as if one should speak from the dead. 29. Yea, it shall come in a day when there shall be heard of fires, and tempests, and vapors of smoke in foreign lands. 30. And there shall also be heard of wars, rumors of wars, and earthquakes in diverse places. And if anyone thinks, aha, Donnikin is a Mormon, well, they can think again. I am indeed a spiritual and religious man, fully convinced of the creation at the hands of the great spirit of creation, as I think of the unfathomable one, but I certainly do not belong to any church or religious grouping. The legacies. There's something wrong with our past. That's a conclusion that is 100% certain and even attestable. There are ancient texts, like the book of the prophet Enoch, who learned the language of the extraterrestrials, quotes their names, and finally disappears into the firmament in a fiery chariot with the vague promise that he will, one day, return to good old Earth. I wrote extensively on this subject in my last book, History is Wrong. There is Manetho, the hard-working chronicler in ancient Egypt, whose lists include 380 kings with names and dates that modern Egyptology wants nothing to do with. Or there's the church father Eusebius, who, just like Herodotus and his historian colleague Diodorus, listed the dates of bygone leaders that make contemporary archaeologists cringe. We are certainly not on the right path as far as ancient human history is concerned. We ought to be proud of the fact that extraterrestrial gods instructed our forefathers. Instead, archaeologists and other ologists are too busy fighting over the correct interpretation of ancient written records. Is there anything we humans don't fight over? Herodotus and company are accused of erring and even lying because, let's face it, contemporary knowledge is the culmination of all our experience from the past to the present. But how can that be when we ignore the wisdom of the early historians? Our current knowledge is the be-all and end-all? Hogwash! We spurn not only the ancient observers, but also the visible, tangible, photographable, rock-hard evidence right under our noses. Underneath the Temple of Sethos I in Abydos, Egypt, lies an extremely impressive megalithic puzzle, something that every tourist can see, and something that is clearly very much older than the Sethos Temple itself. Does anybody care? Daniel Russo, former lawyer and Jesuit student in Peru, presented a series of stone monuments that all clearly had their origins in an unknown prehistoric age. No branch of science felt that this had anything to do with them. There is practically never any money available for financing research. The same is the case for the inexplicable high plateau El Enladrillado in Chile. This lies in the province of Talca, around 37 miles to the east of the town of Talca, and not far from Altos de Vilches, roughly 35 degrees, 37 minutes south, 71 degrees, 5 minutes west. At an altitude of around 6,500 feet lie hundreds of stone blocks, all perfectly cut and furrowed, clearly an artificial construction. But from whom? Whoever it was lived in a time earlier than any known culture in Chile. Therefore, they don't fit into our evolutionary pattern, just like Pumapunku in the highlands of Bolivia. Humberto Sarnato Banaud, the leader of a small expedition to El Enladriado in fall 1968, noted, "There is no doubt that a previous ancient culture once lived here. The indigenous people of this zone would never have been capable of constructing anything on this scale." In 2008, the young Chilean teacher Rafael Eisman visited the mysterious plateau. He put together an extremely well-documented and well-researched publication on the mysterious El Enladriado and told me personally, "There is certainly something not right here. No tribe has lived on this plateau for thousands of years. If they had done, the Chilean archaeologists would know about it. So these cut blocks must have been put here by some really ancient culture." Which science or which research foundation is going to pick up the ball and run with this? In Chapter 1, I told you about the heavyweight platforms in Pumapunku, Bolivia. I discussed the perfectly cut blocks with the millimeter-wide grooves that couldn't possibly have been made with Stone Age tools or have been the result of Stone Age planning talents, certainly not in any culture that we know of. I showed you the precise calendar calculations carried out by Dr. Edmund Kiss. You can go back and take another listen if you like. In fact, I recommend you do. Kiss's year was 12 months of 24 days, with each day being made up of 30 hours, which were 22 minutes long. This calendar agrees exactly with the Mayan calendar and, what's more, reaches 10,000 years back into the past. Is anyone anywhere getting excited about it? Is anyone jumping up in excitement about these millimeter-precise calculations? Is there any chief editor crying out, "Man, that's just unbelievable!" before going out to drum up money for research projects? Society has become sluggish and lazy, overfed by the internet, and crushed by a zeitgeist that immediately stifles any enthusiasm. Too lazy to take notice of anything important or groundbreaking. Our attitude toward these old truths will have no influence on the return of the gods. They'll be back, and their mere presence will shake our self-satisfied souls to the core. December 23rd, 2012. That is the date from the Maya calendar. Even if this date is not the one, the God shock will still come. You can bet your life on it.